And I guess there was overtime in the last committee. It's not at all that the committee doesn't care, just there's a lot going on.
Just got that with our committee.
So anyway, 3/12, and it's March 25th. What is it, March? Yeah. And we have with us today Representative Lynn, Representative Seaton, Co-Chair Heron, and Representative Tammy Wilson. The first thing we'll be looking at today is CS for House Bill 309. And I believe that we'll have the sponsor come forward. We've closed public testimony, and we'll see where we go from there. We probably may just leave it closed and go to committee discussion, but we'll leave that option open for a little bit. So if the sponsor or the sponsor's representative for 309 is out there. So is your boss coming too then? Yeah. If you would like to go ahead and state your name for the record and start out.
Good afternoon. My name is Cecile Elliott, staff to Representative Bill Thomas. You have before you the CS for House Bill 309, version C, which is the result of a compromise between the dental community, the insurance industry, and the small business community. I'd like to tell you basically what the CS does, and then if it's your wish, I can go line by line what the changes. The original House bill had two provisions, one establishing a minimum and maximum age limit. That has been removed from the bill entirely because in further research, it was found that that is covered in other parts of statute, that dependents are covered from birth, and there is a legal opinion of that available. So the second provision was prohibiting fee capping. We changed language in the bill to reflect the compromise between industry, and it offers dentists the opportunity to sign a contract for covered services or a contract that has a fee schedule of covered and non-covered services. And Dr. David Logan is here. If it's the committee chooses, he's available to speak to that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to go line by line. I think it might be more confusing that way, but I'm happy to do that. I have that available if you would.
Well, we'll start out with try questions, but first of all, a couple things. Representative Holmes has joined us. Representative Sista is excused, by the way, today. And I need somebody to move the CS.
Mr. So Chairman, move to adopt CS for House Bill 309, Hess C version.
Seeing no objection, then that's what we have before us is C version. So what we'll do is go right to questions for the sponsor. Did you have a question or something?
Yes, I do. And I might miss it, so I apologize if I have. This bill does not affect the state insurance or borough self-insured type of policies. Is that true?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct.
Okay. Follow-up, sir? So this would only affect the small business who have insurance policies through Blue Cross, Blue Shield, those types of policies?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, currently in the bill, it references preferred provider contracts.
Could you give me a definition?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Dr. David Logan is here, and I'd like to answer that and then defer. Preferred provider contracts are a contract negotiated between the insurance company and the dentist. On a fee schedule, and Dr. David Logan can give you the details on that if you like.
Did you want to follow up with
it? I just have one more question.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Is there any way to have the state or the self-insured abide by these same rules? Is there even a mechanism for that? Okay, he can answer whenever he gets there. I can wait for the answer.
if you have a response, David, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Logan. I'm a dentist here in Juneau, Alaska, and I'm representing the Alaska Dental Society. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, couple of questions you had there, and I'll back up to the first one and then kind of move forward if that's okay there. Generally, there's two broad categories of insurance. There's indemnity plans, the traditional insurance plans, which you go in, you see a provider, the provider bills the insurance pays a percentage of the treatment or the service rendered there. The other type will be under managed care plans, each are under HMOs, which really don't exist in this state for dental, and PPO plans. And a PPO plan is a preferred provider organization. The insurance company has contracted with dentists there to provide services at a negotiated fee schedule there. The negotiation is a broad-based fee schedule that where the dentists as a individually agree to what's a set fee schedule. So there's not an individual negotiation, but a presentation by the insurance company, and you either sign for the contract for that fee or not there. So those are kind of the two general categories. Regarding how this affects self-insured plans or ERISA plans, that has overlying federal legislation there, and that unfortunately will be at the federal level, which I know there's been a long history of work on the ERISA legislation, but that hasn't happened to date.
Okay, thank you.
Are there more questions for the sponsor or David?
Mr. Chairman?
Everybody on the seat?
We've adopted the CS, so.
Yes, sir.
And I talked to the sponsor's representative earlier, and my question revolves around the insured as being the consumer from both a dentist and from an insurance company. And the question of the insured having a preferred provider network, knowing to go to docs, and then having a contracted fee schedule, and then that fee schedule not applying to them as soon as a coverage limit is reached or something. So does this bill propose to make sure that the insurance company is notifying their insureds that if they go to docs that have not taken the broad general contract the way it's been offered previously in Alaska and has this new opt-out provision, how are the insurance company going to notify us clients that if we select one of those doctors, our charges may be higher for any non-covered service?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I spoke to the insurance folks today, excuse me, and asked that he be here to answer that question. It's my understanding that the insurance company provides that information to the consumer. How they do it, under what conditions they do it, they would answer that question. And also, I'd like to point out that they provided this language in the bill.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on this point, you know, we have on page 2 this permissive language on line 15 that the terms of the contract may authorize the insurer to provide information to the insured. But we're changing from the existing system in Alaska that requires the PPO to have a set amount of fee to now having fees, or as soon as those are not covered, then the fees can be higher. And so I think that we need to make sure that the clients, the insured, are notified. So at some point, I would like to make sure that we change that portion there so that the insurer, if they're offering this contract, does actually provide the information to the insurer. And I don't know if there's someone from the insurance company that'll be here to testify, but I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that I have a you know, a problem with that language in this.
And just for the committee's info here, we got Dennis Bailey's online from Legal Services too, and he may have a some input as far as whether we're in the right section to be, you know, talking about notification on patients, because that's my, I'm not real clear if this is where it goes. But any other questions? We, by the way, we have somebody here from the insurance company. Reed Stoops is here, so we'll ask him to come forward. And what I'm going to do then, but stay there where there may be more questions, but I will go ahead and open this back up to public testimony. There's several from the Alaska Dental Society that wanted to say something too, but is there any questions here more for the sponsor? Reverend Seaton.
Just one. With this new uncapped plan, is there anything in the CS that requires the dentist to notify the patients that are coming in as to their office based on their insurance, and they're coming in under the preferred provider network, that their fees may no longer be capped?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think Dr. David Logan can answer that.
Through the chair, would you mind repeating the question? Sorry.
I'm trying to find out if in the CS, since we now have a situation in which the fees can be uncapped or are different than they were before, that the dentists themselves notify the clients in the preferred provider network when they come into the office that the fees may be higher than that listed in a schedule that's provided by the insurer under the CAP program.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton.
David Logan, go ahead and.
There's no statutory requirement for that under the CS, or there is no statutory requirement that a provider would provide that information to a patient regardless of the insurance company. But as a general office policy, I think all providers strive to let patients know, consumers know, what their fee structure is and what the services and charges that they're going to incur are there. But there's no statutory requirement, regardless of the insurance type, that that information is provided.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For clarification, would you help me understand what the on page 2, line 6, and it talks, and down on line 10 also, it talks about the insurer may not take action against the dentist. Would you put that in some kind of something other than legalese? I mean, are we talking a lawsuit here? What's up?
Through the chair, David Logan again there. Through the chair, the intent there was that if a dentist was to sign either a contract for covered services or a contract for both covered and non-covered services, that there wouldn't be a differential in the fee schedule that would apply to consumers based on the contract type for the covered services, or that they would fail to present the provider as a member of the panel. There is statutory language further down in the bill that the insurers may differentiate between the type of contract the provider has signed, but not fail to notify the insured that the dentist has signed to a contract.
I have no follow-up. Okay. So thank you for your testimony. And I think we'll ask Reed to come up, and maybe he can address, if you would. Identify yourself for the record, and do you need repeat on the question, or did you follow it from back there?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Reed Stoops, and I'm here today on behalf of Aetna. I'm not here to offer testimony, but I am willing to answer any questions that I'm able, or find the right person if I'm unable. And I did hear a couple questions, and maybe I could start with those, and
please do.
I'll answer any other ones that committee members may have. I heard one question from Representative Wilson about ERISA. And I think you probably need to talk to Linda Hall about that question. I know that ERISA would, a self-insured plan would be exempt from a mandated coverage, for example, if you said, I guess maybe the minimum age part of the bill would be a mandated coverage. I think those sort of things the state would have the option to do or not to do as any other self-insured employer. But I'm not so sure about the contract provision, whether that would, I mean, what you're changing in this bill on the contract portion is you're affecting the contract negotiations between an insurer and a dentist. So whether that's precluded by ERISA, I couldn't answer that, but the expert would be Linda. So I recommend that you ask her. What was the second? It was the other question.
It was on the notification, but on that point first, I just wanted to say that Linda's out of town and couldn't be here today. She has been in the last hearing, but she's not here, not available now. So it was on the notification, as I understood it, what responsibility do you feel to notify the your clients, if they're going to get, whether there's going to be a fee that they weren't aware of? Or
well, right, Mr. Chairman, right now the practice is that there is a an employee handbook that goes out in the state of Alaska. Would be the state of Alaska handbook. In the case of Fred Meyer or another large client, there would be a booklet that goes out that explains the benefits. And normally the patient would get a explanation of benefits in the mail, probably might be as long as 2 weeks or 30 days after that you visit the dentist, that would explain the coverage. And it would say that 80% of your visit is covered and the remainder is not, or you were below the deductible or you were above the deductible. But that's the explanation. Right now there's no, I think, obligation of the insurer to kind of sort out all the details in some sort of prior notice. So I guess if this bill passes, I would expect that the insurer will have to figure out how they would change their procedure, to provide notice, whether it's through a website or some other sort of notification. But I guess it would also seem reasonable to for the provider to share in that burden as well, because it's a change that affects lots of people in lots of circumstances. I can try to get you more specific. That question came up this morning, and I got a general answer in the brief period before the hearing today. I'm happy to work on that further.
Representative Tammy Wilson.
Thank you. How would this change the rates? That's what every time we add something like this, the small businesses, say that their rates go up because you're covering more things. So how much could this impact the insurance for small businesses making these kind of changes?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I wouldn't expect it would change the cost of insurance, because the insurer is only paying for covered services. Would it increase the cost to the consumer? If the dentists end up charging a greater amount than the fee schedule that was negotiated, then the consumer would pay a higher fee for non-covered service. But I think you'd have to ask Dr. Logan or some of the dentists that are online today about that, because ultimately it's their decision.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wilson, Seaton, go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, just on that point, would you anticipate, since I guess it's not negotiated rates, but you set rates that trying to have lower rates for your customers, would you presume that under this system of a different fee for non-covered services, that there would be any circumstances in which these non-covered services would be provided at less cost than they would provide the cost through the insurance fee schedule?
Through the chair to Representative Seaton, I guess that would be up to the dentist. The dentist certainly could charge less, but on the other hand, I would assume that the costs would be greater, or there wouldn't be a great need for this legislation. But again, I think you'd need to ask that question of them, because it would be their rates and not the insurer's rates that are affected.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
And this is a follow-up on the question that I asked on page 2, line 15, where it says, may authorize the insurer to provide information to the insured. Do you, as the insurance provider or representative of insurers, have any problem with changing that from may authorize you to the requirement that you shall notify the insureds of, you know, basically two lists, one that's going to cap all the fees and the other list that these dentists are signed up and uncovered services they can charge what they want?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that I'll have to find out. I attempted to get the answer to that before the hearing today and was unable to, but I'm happy to try to get a more specific answer because I don't know exactly what the procedure costs will be. I assume if it's a website, that wouldn't be too difficult if the insurer, Aetna has a website, but not all insurers do. But I don't know the specific answer to that, but I'm happy to get that for you.
And just one
follow-up.
And so as I understand that these are all going forward contracts, not going back. So if you, what doesn't matter, it was Fred Meyer, the state, or whoever, these dentists would all be, have these contracts before you send out your booklet, I mean, because otherwise you're not being able to tell who's in the preferred provider network at all. So the question I'm wanting to get to is, if you're able to provide a list, that means you know what contract, who signed up with the contract. So if they've signed up in one or the other, you would obviously know that before a booklet went out. And then do you update that list periodically through the website? Is that the mechanism?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's not quite that neat because there would be a number of existing contracts that would be affected by the legislation. And as I understand it, dentists would be able to opt out of the non-covered service portions of those contracts without having to reissue a new contract. That was one of the insurers' concerns, is that they didn't want to have to void all contracts and reissue new ones. And I assume that would happen on a rolling basis. You know, as individual dentists made up their mind about whether to opt out, there'd be a notification process, they would opt out, and then that particular dentist would no longer be covered. That's not going to happen simultaneously, nor do the booklets come out all the time. I mean, with the State of Alaska booklet, you know, it may be a period of years before that booklet comes back out again. That's why I hesitate to say exactly how it would happen, because this doesn't only apply to a prospective contract that might take place in the future. This applies to contracts that are already in existence that would be modified.
Dr. Logan, is that, I just wanted to confirm that that was consistent with your view.
if you would direct your comments to the chair, sure. It makes it really tough for the secretary to catch nods and discussions like that.
I truly apologize.
So, running a very good ship there, but we did have the David Logan come back up, and so David, if you would identify yourself for the record again, and
thank you, Mr. Chair. David Logan, a dentist in Juneau, Alaska. And I'm apologize, but I missed the question, though. But I will be happy to respond when I hear the question.
Go ahead, Reed.
It's kind of unusual. Let me pose the question back through the chair to Dr. Logan. I think the question that Representative Seaton was trying to get at is, was there some neat way to provide advance notification on the results of contractual changes that might result from this legislation? And my answer was that this is likely to happen on a rolling basis, that we're talking about a number of contracts that are already in existence that a dentist might choose to opt out of the non-covered service. That may happen. It won't happen simultaneously. Different dentists would do it at different times. And that then the question would become, once that happens, what kind of notification would be appropriate to an insured of Aetna or a patient of yours, and I couldn't answer the question precisely because of the way it's going to happen. It's something that will require some thought, and I just wanted to make sure that I didn't answer the question in a way that was different than your understanding of how the legislation would work.
Did you have a response, David?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Reed presented a good point there. It does present one of the challenges in general with any sort of notification to the consumer that these contracts are always rolling. There's opt-out clauses for the insurance companies. There's opt-out clauses for the dentists, also providers also, as well as new providers agreeing to sign up at any period in time during the year. So there's always a constant roll of the roster of who's providing, who's a provider for the contracts there. So I would imagine that there would kind of be an equal challenge to both parts of that, trying to identify which providers at any given moment are members of a PPO, as well as which ones would be members of either the bifurcation that we're speaking of.
As long as you're both here, I would like to ask Reed a question and then give David a chance to respond. But it's kind of a general question. But what, when you get into just the primary care and away from the dental stuff, I mean, why has this not come up there? I mean, what's the difference? I mean, they have their preferred provider contracts also, right? I'm assuming. And I see Rod in the corner back there trying to hide. We might get him up here, but but it would really be helpful if we could understand that a little bit. You know, I mean, is this a new trend that we're going to be seeing more of, or what's are you guys leading the way? I mean, this is more, that's more for David, but Reed, what do you, is this happening on the other fronts?
Mr. Chairman, this is Reed Stoops. To my knowledge, it hasn't happened on the physician side or the hospital side or the medical side yet. I assume that this happened on the dental side because the dentist took this initiative starting this past year on this type of legislation, but I guess I'm not sure that there's a huge difference between dentists and doctors on this point, but I have no idea what the medical community has in mind.
It was just, did you want to respond?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, certainly. David Logan again there. I can't speak for how it works with the physicians and how they base decisions upon whether to join PPOs or not. Part of the reason that dentists join PPOs, though, is with the knowledge that you're going to present a certain amount of care at what amounts to a discount rate there, and that's the incentive for the patients to join or insurers or the employers to sign for the PPO plans there. For the dentist, while you may offer a certain amount of care at a discount rate, you have a couple of things. You're filling chair time, and sometimes that's valuable to you if it's otherwise going to be on-filled time. But also you're charging your customary rates for services that might not otherwise be covered under insurance plans. Classic examples would be cosmetic dentistry and orthodontics. And so as you get additional traffic through your office there, as people are coming in under the PPO plans, part of your ability to still maintain profitability by having those patients there is offering those other services and charging your usual rates for those services there.
If you would, just stay there. Dennis Bailey, are you online? From Legal Services?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, if you've been listening to this conversation, and I think if you have anything to help us clarify a few things, you know, if you haven't been listening, we'll try to ask some intelligent questions, but I will give you first a chance just to clarify a little bit.
If you have a specific question or an area that you'd like me to try and discuss, I can do that. The other speakers have seemed to have been doing a pretty good job of explaining how the bill works.
Okay, as I understood the question, and I would ask the committee to help me out there here, but it has to do with when this bill goes into effect. Does it, how does it affect the current contracts, future contracts, you know, I mean, in the context of being able to get information out to the consumer?
Mr. Chairman, legislation is normally prospective, which means that this bill, if it passed, would only apply to future contracts. So I expect that the rolling changes that have been explained to the committee would also apply to the changes that are under the bill. So as a new contract comes up and is agreed to or expired, or if an opt-out provision is exercised, that's when the new rules would also apply. We can also add a specific applicability section to the bottom of the bill that says essentially that.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. Does anyone else have a question for legal services? Representative Seaton?
I do, and can let me follow up on this one.
Sure, go ahead.
So I guess I heard two different things. I heard from the testifiers here that there was a provision that lets them, without renewing their contract, just do an opt-out provision. And so if that's in there, can you point that to me?
If there's nothing in the bill that specifically says that, if there's a contract term that says that you can opt out of your contract or change your contract, I think that contract term would apply. If there's not, then I don't think you can apply the bill or the terms of the provisions of the bill to a contract that's already in place before the bill is enacted. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton, do you have another question then?
I did, and that was I'm concerned about with preferred provider network having two different types of contracts, and I want to make sure that the insured has full notification of that. And with these kind of rolling contract terms, I'm looking at line 15 there and wanting to ask whether if we would change that to something like shall require that both the insurer and the dentist provide information to the insured describing the dentist's choice of contract and fee schedules. Would that language get to my concern of making sure that the individual who's insured would understand before they got services what situation they're going to be in?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think you have the option or the changes would be allowed that would make the providing information mandatory in the bill. With regard to the insurance aspects of it, those obligations to notify an insured may already exist in the insurance statute. I don't have a specific reference to that, but you could make it more explicit for the particular contracts that are addressed in this bill by just making the providing of information mandatory and describing what information you want the parties to supply. Yes, you have the option to make it mandatory. It's now permissive.
Thank you. And if, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Seaton, follow up.
And if that was offered as a conceptual amendment to change that wording on line 15 to shall require both the insurer and the dentist to provide information, would that get us where you think I'm trying to go?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think that generally says it. I mean, essentially, you may be able to do it by changing may to shall, And then if you want to include both the insurer and the provider, I think that would also work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dennis. Representative Wilson, do you have a question for Dennis?
Well, I just thought Representative Seaton may not have seen this. It might help answer his question on this amendment.
Well, I think it's a little different issue, but we'll go there. We'll get there in a little bit. Thank you so much, Dennis. And thank you, unless there's more questions for the sponsor or for Reed or for the Dental Associate Society here. We'll go online. There's a couple of people online that we want to testify in. Okay, Chris Henry.
Yes, my name is Chris Henry, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Dental Society. I don't really have much to add to testimony. I've kind of been online listening for the last 50 minutes or so, and I'd be glad to answer any further questions that you guys might have or anything there as far as related to 309.
Thank you for taking time. I don't see any questions at this point, and thank you for taking time to listen in. Jim Toll?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Toll, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society. I think at this point, Mr. Chairman, I really don't have any testimony that would be constructive. I, too, would be more than happy to attempt to answer any questions that you or the committee members may have regarding House Bill 309 and the what we've negotiated with the insurance industry. I hope you can hear me better than I've been able to hear you over the last 40 minutes.
Oh, wow. We hear you loud and clear, and I apologize if you have not been able to hear very well. I is there anyone else online that would like to testify on this bill? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to give us some wisdom on this HB 309? Okay, public testimony is closed. Discussion in the committee. Representative Wilson.
I just have a comment. I mean, I'm glad that they have worked this out, both sides, but I am still one that if the state is not doing this or making the, you know, the boroughs and others who, you know, have the majority of people in their programs not do it, I would hope that we would help them get to that point. But I'm glad that the maker of this bill seems to go to both sides and made both sides happy, but that's just one of my little peeves. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you want me to move the amendment?
Yes. Is there any amendments pending?
Mr. Chairman, amendment number one, page one, line 14, after parenthetical two, insert not N-O-T.
An objector so he can explain.
Okay, we have an objection. Discussion. Sponsors, representative, come on up.
Thank you. Cecile Elliott, staff to Representative Bill Thomas. When there was changes made in the bill, removing sections, it was just an oversight. And so the amendment is there for that reason to correct that. Not should be in front of, not limit, should say.
For what it's worth, I see what happened, but it made me chuckle because that's a pretty important word. Any comments from the committee?
I will remove my objection.
Okay. Seeing no further objection, Amendment 1 is adopted. Any other amendments pending on this bill?
Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment.
Conceptual amendment. Go right ahead.
And I guess that would be Amendment 2. And that would be on page 2, line 15. That would delete the words may authorize and insert after the parenthetical II, shall require both, and then insert after insurer and the dentist.
Any discussion on the
object
first for discussion? Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to read the way the line would read?
That'd be great. Super.
So parenthetical II would then read, shall require both the insurer and the dentist to provide information to the insured describing the dentist's choice of contract and fee schedules.
Can we ask the maker what they think of that? Or?
Yeah, sure. Representative Wilson, go right in.
Could you please respond to that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the sponsor is neutral on the amendment and defers to the will of the committee.
Any other comments on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman,
on the amendment? Yes. Mm-hmm. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping we could maybe ask Mr. Logan the question as well. I very much support what I think is the intent of the amendment of making sure that the information gets out to the public. I just want to make sure that we're not accidentally driving up costs in what way they would be required to provide the information. I just want to
The public testimony that we closed, and we have the sponsor's representative here. So you could ask the sponsor's representative, I guess,
okay,
what she thinks about what the about that. But we could open it back up if we really want to address that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask the sponsor's representative.
Please do.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, regarding whether or not this would drive up costs, would be the dental community and the insurance company would need to answer that question. I couldn't speculate.
Okay, well, we'll open up public testimony just a little bit here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just don't think it's the intent.
And we'll go, I'm sorry, did you have another
comment? Excuse me, Chair Keller, Cecile Elliott, staff to Representative Thomas. I just wanted to make a clarification. Representative Seaton in his amendment said insured, and it's insure. But that wasn't changing. I just want to clarify.
The insurer and the dentist.
Oh, yes, I didn't change the word insurer.
Right.
So if I misspoke, Mr. Chairman, that sentence would read, shall require both the insurer and the dentist to provide information. That's the way that line 15 would read. So I'm not changing the word insurer. Apparently, I might have misspoke and said insured.
Right.
And if that was the case, that was not the intention of the amendment.
I think that's clear. It's clear to me anyway. So. Okay, did you have another question for the sponsor?
No, I was.
Because we have a question pending here, I opened up public testimony. Yeah. David, did you want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Logan. Regarding the part about whether a separate Representative Seaton's amendment would raise costs for the dental community, and we're talking about a sheet of paper, possibly a little postage, we're good as far as that goes. That won't be reflected in an increase in dental rates.
Okay. Public testimony is getting cool. Oh, no. You're going to
be. I tried to stop you.
We'll open public testimony again. We're keeping Butch busy over there. Representative Wilson had a question
for
David Logan.
If I'm reading this right, I just want to make sure that, I mean, I'm reading this as you're going to show your contract and parts of the fees to where it won't be some. Each person can look at each dentist's fees and things by contract versus judge. I don't know. I just think maybe I'm reading it wrong. How do you read this? What would you be giving people based on this? Maybe that's what I need to know.
Through the chair, David Logan again. My understanding is that it would be providing information to the insured whether or not you are abiding to the contract that's for covered services only, and otherwise for covered and non-covered services. And my interpretation would be if you are not within the fee caps for non-covered services, you would provide information to the patients as to what the fees would be for those particular services.
Follow up.
So
you wouldn't see it as showing a whole line of fee schedules, both inside your contract and outside your contract?
Through the chair, no. The covered fee schedule is through the insurance company. It's a negotiated rate, and I don't know if they share that with the insured or not. I'm not privy to that information, to be honest there. But I would feel that as the provider that we should provide the information to the insured for services that aren't covered under that covered fee schedule, that if we're outside what the negotiated fees are, that information needs to be provided to the consumer.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Representative Seaton, did you?
And Mr. Chairman, just for clarity, I'm just modifying the language that was brought forward by the dentists in the insured community that they had negotiated those terms of discussion. And so my intention is so that the insured person, who the covered person is going in, has information on what it's going to cost that person when they get services. So if it's a non-covered service, you know, it can be at the desk, it can be on the wall, it can be however they do it. It's the information that's got to be relayed. So if there's any question, I just want to put it on the record that since this is a conceptual amendment, that is the intention of the amendment.
Okay.
Go
ahead. Public testimony is closed. Now that we've closed it, I'll make my comment. Have you ever thought about how to say no thanks when your mouth is wide open and your head is back? Is that when you tell him the price? I got him here when he can't respond. You know, I see. Okay, so if see any other questions for the sponsor or the sponsor's representative, what's the wish of the committee?
We have an amendment on table, Mr. Chair.
An objection.
Yeah, we move my objection.
Okay, any other further discussion on the amendment? Thank you, Representative Seaton. None. Amendment is adopted. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Are we under committee discussion?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I can understand this. I'm somewhat uncomfortable if we are establishing a procedure that could roll through the hospital and the medical community, because I think that what that could do is serve to raise costs on individuals throughout the system. So although, you know, I'm willing to not hold this up, I just want to make everybody aware that I would not look kindly at expanding this to all the medical fields and the hospitals and everything, as far as having two sets of preferred provider network in the medical community, and then having charges above what are negotiated for those medical rates.
thank you for putting it on the record. It's a good point. I would also like to add that the new legislation that has, whatever state it is in Washington, D.C., there's no doubt some things that will bring this topic back before us, because there's an insurance exchange and a number of things. And I basically would like the committee to point that out every time we take action on a bill, because we don't have enough information, so we may have to readdress this issue along with many others as we move along, because we don't expect to have, I mean, it isn't even resolved yet in over there, so we don't know where it's going to go. So with the information we have, I would like to move the bill today. Representative Lynn.
On the same topic, the national health insurance thing, is dental services covered? You know, I confess I haven't read the 2,700 pages, but I'm not in Congress. But I just, is dental services included?
Representative Lynn, I can't even answer that, and I think that's the problem, exactly the problem we have before us.
Through the chair?
We'll take it at ease here. Go ahead. we'll have a lot of discussions, probably a lot of times we won't know what we're saying when it comes to the health care reform for some time. Anyway, any further discussion on this bill? Representative Wilson.
I can move it if we're still discussing.
Please do.
I can move CS for House Bill number 309 as amended, backslash C as amended, sorry about that, from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
That's right. It's version C, a blank CS at this point. Thank you. The bill moves from committee, and thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move right along. We'll pass the paperwork through as we go here. So what we'd like to do now is move to HB 361. Try to make the best use of the minutes we have.
Thank you.
If you would, state your name for the record and tell us what a wonderful bill you have before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Keenum, and staff to Representative Fairclough. She does send her regards. She's up in a finance meeting right now. But what we have before us is House Bill 361, an act relating to 911 dispatchers being trained in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, otherwise known as CPR. We believe that it would be an important step for 911 dispatchers to be trained in CPR. Currently, Alaska is one of 18 states that does not mandate that. So, Mr. Chairman, I also know that you do have a blank CS before you. Don't know if you want me to explain that switch really quickly or...
Thank you. Does somebody want to move the blank CS that we have before us?
Yes, sir. CS for House Bill 361, version R.
Okay, that's the version R before us. Proceed and tell us the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After our meeting that we had in Community and Regional Affairs, there was some discussion between the Department of Public Safety as well as the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Currently, right now, the 911 coordinator is housed under Military and Veterans Affairs. The discussion was that necessarily the right place to have that coordinator? And both departments are here to answer any questions about that. It is my understanding that that Department of Public Safety would be more than willing to take on that 911 coordinator. And currently in Military and Veterans Affairs, the person that is doing the job of the 911 coordinator is doing it as other duties as assigned. And so after those conversations, we decided that we'd move it over to public safety, and that's why we have the blank CS before you.
Before we ask for questions, just realize we have representatives here from both the Department of Public Safety and Military and Veterans Affairs if the committee has questions there. Representative Wilson.
How would this affect the bush? I mean, would you have to have a certified CPR person in each one of those communities or do they even have a 911 system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, it would affect the bush. It would affect, well, most municipalities currently, Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, Soldotna, and Nome, their 911 dispatchers are trained as emergency medical dispatchers, which is a higher level of training, which does incorporate CPR and other duties. The dispatchers that are out in the bush, if they don't have CPR training, they would be required to have it. One of the things we thought about how exactly we would go about that with the long distances and everything. Online, you can actually get a CPR certification. It's about $20. In your packet, there is a...
I don't want them working on me.
There is all the information from that online resource with a copy of the certificate and all of that. So there are ways to go through a CPR training that we believe is an important resource for people to have, especially those that are responding to emergency calls.
Follow up. I don't even know where to start on this. I mean, I understand the concept, but if we had somebody train themselves online, there would really be no way of knowing whether or not they understand the concept. I mean, so I just didn't think you could do that. I'm sorry. I'm trying to think at the same time. But so you're not thinking of a person who would make sure that these people are trained. The public safety or military veterans, whoever went in there, would it make those decisions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, that's one of the duties of the 911 coordinator, would be to facilitate and monitor that training for CPR. So they would ultimately be the ones that would ensure that it does, in fact, happen.
Follow up,
Representative Wilson.
Do you know how many communities, because you said Fairbanks and Anchorage and those already go beyond that, how many communities with 911 are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, it's been a struggle trying to get that information. I have been trying to find out exactly those that don't, so I can't give you a specific number, but I am trying to get responses back from as many communities as I possibly can for that. There's a whole lot of them out here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Recently, there was news that they were suggesting you don't do airway breathing, that it's just 100 beats per minute, and you forget about pulmonary resuscitation, you're doing cardiac resuscitation. The wording that we have in this bill, is that going to be antiquated as soon as that's fully adopted in all, for emergency medical situations? And are we actually putting in a requirement for something that is passe and is, we're actually going to be mandating that you do something that they no longer suggest doing? Is there a wording change or something that we may need to put in here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, off the top of my head, I don't know for sure. I do know that they are leaning more towards, you know, just the chest pumps versus the mouth-to-mouth. I don't know if the representatives from Military and Veterans Affairs or Public Safety might be able to provide better information on that. And if not, we will absolutely follow up with you and make sure that question gets answered for you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have further questions for the sponsor's representative? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. We were trying to look for a fiscal note. We thought maybe we just didn't get it. Is there a fiscal note with this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we are waiting for the new fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety, and Sue Stancliffe from the department is here to answer questions about the fiscal note. The thought is they might have been waiting for the blank CS to be adopted before coming out with the new fiscal note. This does have a finance referral, so I do know that they will do their due diligence up there.
For the committee, before we go to another question on that topic, we don't have the fiscal note in front of us. There is a fiscal impact. And it's up to the committee what you do with it, but I would recommend that we push it out and go to the finance committee and let them make the decision. It will be a fiscal note to cover one full-time employee, I believe. But we can ask the department that here shortly. Representative Lynn.
Yeah. I don't think it was covered. Are you going to speak to the pros and cons of moving the position from Military Veterans Affairs Department of Public Safety? Why? What are the pros and cons?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn, I do have, you know, people from the both departments here. Through our conversations that we had, neither one object to the move. It's one of those things that was thrown into Military and Veterans Affairs, from my understanding, because they believed that they would have federal money coming in for that position. But the departments are here to answer those more specifically.
So from the sponsor's position, he believes it should be, or she believes it should be done. Is that correct? And she must have had a reason. Do you know what that was?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn, it was through our discussions with the two departments that we decided to make that change.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from the committee, let's ask, where do we start? Does anyone want to hear from, just talk to the committee here a little bit. Do you want to hear from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs?
Absolutely. They're ready.
Okay. We'll start with, why don't you both come up? Because you both agreed to this, so. If you would, we can start with Mike, if you would identify yourself for the record, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Michael O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. It's a pleasure to be here. To answer the question, a little bit of history of why it's a good thing to move it over to from Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to Department of Public Safety. This part of the statute of 2623-170 was moved over in 2004. The end of session was kind of last-minute addition to the responsibilities under that segment for emergency communications. It was to potentially acquire some 911 federal funding when and if it came up upon us. The concept of 2623-170 is to provide our responsibility in Military and Veterans Affairs is to provide tactical emergency communications in a catastrophic disaster. So if all comms are out, we have tactical capabilities that we can go in, establish communications with the community and out to the Emergency Operations Center and out as we need it. So that's the intent of that section of our statutes. This addition of the day-to-day 911 systems, 911 administration coordination, very appropriately belongs over in Department of Public Safety. We have had discussions about it and very healthy discussions about it, and we are all on the same page. I'll let my colleague here discuss that, but the intent of the statute by which it resides it's not appropriate for 911 coordination to be there. So I want to just bring that out to the committee. Thank you very much.
Hello. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize that I don't have a copy in front of me of AS 2623-170B. So I was just wondering is the position that's laid out in section one of this bill that creates a statewide 911 coordinator in DPS, is that the same description? Are those the same duties that the position has currently in your department?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
I believe Representative Seaton had a question. Is CPR still CPR?
and I can answer as Michael O'Hare. My CPR certification went out a long time ago, but I can explain. Reading the statute, it is the current requirement as it applies. So if you're being CPR certified for a provision now that only requires chest pumps, as you get recertified, there will be that re-education of that new technique. So did I answer that? I'm seeing a look on your face, Representative. I didn't answer your question, so.
Well, thank you. It's just that I'm not sure that's cardiopulmonary resuscitation is still the new term of art, and I wanted to make sure that we're not establishing in statute a term that refers to a procedure that isn't going to be recommended anymore. And that's just my question.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it seems as though the term would still be that term. I don't know for a fact, but it would seem so that CPR would provide a current technique, whether that be to include the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as well or just the chest pumps. It would be a technique. That would be have to be, if it is changed, it would have to be changed in the statute as it moves around, sir.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I just want the sponsor and the department to make sure that's the case, because I would hate to put something in statute that then we have to go back and change the terminology in the future. That's it.
So if you with the sponsor sitting there and she's nodding, right, when we get into finance, we'll make sure this is a proper term. This is not authoritative, but I have talked to somebody that went through CPR, they still called it CPR, and they had been taught the new technique. Yep. So, but I would hate to have it go on that authority. I still would like some checking on that, too. So, any other questions for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs? If not, does the Department of Public Safety have anything to add?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill. We have worked collaboratively with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs as well as a sponsor. A couple of issues two parts of this bill. One is moving the position, the other one is CPR. So on the issue of CPR, we have put out a poll to the agencies, just like Crystal had spoke to previously, trying to get the information as to who does require it, who doesn't require it, et cetera. By far, just on the information we've gotten back, which is incomplete at this point, those who have responded, every one of them so far, with the exception of one that is still uncertain, do require CPR. Most of our, in fact, they, to back up, they don't just require CPR. They are actually trained beyond that. They're not required beyond that, but they already do it. So I'm happy to say that most of the state is already doing CPR and EMD work. Further, the 38 dispatchers that the Department of Public Safety has, we leave that determination basically to the detachment commanders, and they are responsible for their own dispatchers in their detachment. I'm happy to say that most of our dispatchers are already CPR trained. However, this would require that function. Not a problem whatsoever, and I assure you that the Department of Public Safety would take that very seriously, and I expect, after talking with the commissioner and our colonel, that we'll be looking at possibly taking that further and what the costs are in going as far as to do the EMD. That's not required in the bill, so we've not included that in a fiscal note, but we did do the CPR in the fiscal note. Given the department standards, I say that off the cuff, but I believe that we would go further than just CPR. On the second issue of moving the 911 coordinator into the Department of Public Safety, we're happy to receive that, not a problem. The only difference is that it would require us to have one person to a 911 coordinator. We don't currently have one. And in Military and Veterans Affairs, as to where another one of their employees does that function as other duties as assigned, we would need to be able to assign someone. They would be under the Alaska State Troopers. That position we see as doing the 911 verification on certification, the tracking methods, tracking that everybody is complying with this law, as well as other duties that we can use to enhance the communications and dispatch across the state. We think that that's a very viable opportunity for us. We're happy to take it on. As far as a fiscal note, now that we have the CS, I expect probably OMB and the governor's office will authorize us. We could, you know, like we spoke previously, is if the committee wishes to move it, they could move it pending the fiscal note, and that's your prerogative, but I will tell you it is in the works. We took it seriously. We wanted to evaluate and get as close as possible. We don't, our fiscal notes are not inflated, and we wanted to make sure. We looked at, did we need an admin assistant for a 911 coordinator? We chose no. Does this position need to have, because they're going to be required to travel, are they going to be required to have a vehicle? We chose no. And we chose those things so that we can keep the cost down. We have limited space in our facility currently, but we'll find a spot. Not a problem. It does take a little bit of startup money to get basic office stuff, which most of it will probably have, but they'll have to have a computer. There's contractual money in it. So when it is authorized, I'm happy to walk it around to each of you individually if you would like. But again, like you said, Mr. Chairman, the Finance Committee will take those under careful consideration and scrutiny. But if you have any questions, I'm certainly happy to answer them, and we will facilitate the move.
We have two, Representative Wilson and Representative Harris.
So at this time, you really don't have an actual number of how many communities that currently do not require CPR.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, currently they're not required to do CPR, so we have no way of knowing because they're not required currently to do it.
Follow up.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
But I thought I understood the sponsor saying that they already knew that Fairbanks and Anchorage and many of those areas do require it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, if they do within the municipal ordinance or within their own municipality individually, and they might, but it is not required in statute to CPR is not mandatory currently. That's what this bill would facilitate.
Maybe I'm not asking my question correctly. What I need to know before I move it out, and this is for me, is, you know, how big of a problem in the state is it? Just because it's not in statute, for me, it's not important as in are they already doing it in their community, whether that's on, you know, local ordinances or not? Or are we targeting only one part of the state where this coordinator may end up doing a lot of traveling because we may be talking the communities outside of the road system and putting on a big burden onto these communities? And that's where my question is stemming from, is how many communities currently are just letting basically anybody answer the 911 calls without proper training?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we have put out the polls to ask all of the police chiefs. We did that on the 9th of March, I believe it was, sent out to all the police chiefs around the state. And at this point, I have heard back from 6 police chiefs. So not all of them have responded to the poll. Everyone that we have talked with so far, with the exception of one that was uncertain, they were all doing it already.
And one final follow-up, please. And I believe that you already answered this, but I just want to make sure that the state troopers currently do this, and then the VPSO, are they required to have CPR training for that job?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, yes. They receive that as part of their training.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue, why can't you do it like the other department did it? Assign it to someone else. Why do we need a brand new body?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, to be honest with you, we would take this very seriously. We would not accept a statutory requirement if we are not able to fulfill that mission. We do take these things seriously, and we do coordination of search and rescues. We do a lot of emergency response. We work collaboratively with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs on emergency calls. So we would take this, you know, and put under it the certification, the tracking of it, as well as any additional training possibly that folks needed. If there was anything that we could do to help the municipalities or the more bush communities, if they needed assistance with training, we would provide that through the 911 coordinator. I don't expect that the 911 coordinator would be limited to CPR certification and training. We don't have a job description for it, since there is no current position to base that on, so we would build it off of the statute, whatever is required of us, and take it, you know, professionally and take on the responsibility very seriously.
Mr. Chairman, Sue, I guess I don't understand. When I was city manager, I worked with the department because we had the after-hours contract for 911. And so, as far as I remember, there was someone that we dealt with that dealt with 911 services like the Bethel situation. So, though, as co-chair of this committee, I believe the health policy on this issue that we're debating is important. I agree that these individuals should have CPR, but I'm having a hard time understanding the need in your department is greater than the need was in the other department about providing these services, because I don't think... Again, I just don't think 911 coordinator is a brand new body that we need to have. I guess comment, if you will, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Herron. I would I don't know exactly what the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has done with it, and I would leave that to Mr. O'Hare to comment on it. I just can tell you that if it's given to us, we would take it, we would not take the responsibility lightly.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and that's no less than anyone expects.
Certainly.
So I guess is the money a lateral move? I mean, does military give up some money to you? I'm not going to stop the bill from moving. I think this is a finance decision, but again, I don't believe we need a brand new body.
We will hear a response here from Military and Veterans Affairs in a bit, but I was thinking that if I was the finance chair, and I'm not, I would be asking, so we're going to get a positive fiscal note, right, Mr. Herr? From Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
No, they don't do anything.
Representative
Herron. I didn't ask a question. I said if I were the chair of finance. No. Please respond. I want you to respond.
Bring some information to the committee. In 2004, when this statute was changed to provide the additional responsibilities of 911 coordinator, it was an unfunded mandate. It was Military and Veterans Affairs, you now have the responsibility for coordinating 911. Since 2004, we've been trying to move it out of our department. It's not that we didn't take it seriously, but it was not in our purview, it was not in our lane, so to speak. So it was connected also with the Alaska Land Mobile Radio when it was under our authorities and responsibilities to fix it, if you will. It has now moved over, Alaska Land Mobile Radio, over to the Department of Administration to further complicate the issue. Those 911 responsibilities, coordination responsibilities, went over to Department of Administration. So the statute is with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs currently. The 911 coordinations are being handled through the Department of Administration since 2004 through the network security officer of Daryl Davis, further complicate the issue. So it's been an unfunded mandate that's been tossed around. To be perfectly honest. So what this CS will do is solidify the responsibility, since it's adding more responsibility to that position, so to speak, it is requiring to be a full-time job. So, yeah.
Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, I can't resist. So what are the duties of the current coordinator?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, to coordinate 911 and enhance 911 throughout the state. So to identify who those 911 dispatchers are, identify technologies that would be appropriate to enhance 911 statewide. It is more of a technologies research and development as new technologies come in, present them to the legislature for approval, look for some federal funding that may be appropriate for 911 communications authority and capabilities, and now if this bill gets passed through, to also coordinate and require statewide 911 dispatchers for other duties, other responsibilities.
Kind of follow up on this question or statement, but my problem with the bill right now is I'm not so sure we're not already doing it. You know, I really want to know what communities this really impacts and whether that's a negative or positive for them. It sounds like our big communities are already doing it through other means, and so far we don't have a list of who doesn't do it. You know, and we know the state police does it, and we know, you know, all these other agencies, you know, that I don't feel comfortable until we know who we're putting this burden on and how that will impact them. I think it's beyond a fiscal issue. This is about, are we putting something in statute that is being done on the local level where it probably needs to be, versus we're going to have somebody running around to all these different communities every time somebody changes over to make sure they're certified. I personally need more information, but that's me.
Any other questions for the Department of Public Safety or Military Veterans Affairs. Okay, is there anybody in the room? By the way, Lieutenant Rodney Dial was online for questions, state troopers, if you have any questions you'd like to direct at him. I forgot to tell you that. Is there anybody online or in the room that would like to testify further on House Bill 361? Lieutenant Dial, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am online.
Representative Wilson has a question for you. Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Maybe you might be able to help me. I hope so. In the smaller communities, you know, do you, on the 911 calls, is it dispatcher somebody besides the state police or the VSBO officers?
For the record, this is Lieutenant Rodney Dial with the State Troopers in Ketchikan. Representative Wilson, there's really not very many small dispatch centers. Most of them are state trooper dispatch centers. There's a few exceptions. Nome is one, but for the most part, places like Kotzebue, Bethel, those are DPS functions. So this really wouldn't impact too many of the smaller communities, mostly just the hub communities in Bush, Alaska, and for the most part, those are our facilities. And regarding CPR training, we do that on a detachment level as time permits. We do have a requirement to train our troopers in CPR and bloodborne pathogens per certain standards. So when able, we get our dispatchers in there as well, and we've done that down here in Southeast.
Follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
Can you think of a community that this would impact?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, impact in a negative way or make them do something that they're not currently doing? I can't think of one. I think that most communities are going to have most of their dispatchers at some level of emergency medical dispatch training already, more as a liability issue than anything else. I would mention one possible concern that came up when I was researching this issue. Being trained how to provide CPR and actually providing instructions over a telephone line on how to provide CPR, two different things. We're not convinced at this point that the American Heart Association would certify people to, or dispatchers, to provide CPR instructions over the phone after having received CPR training. So that's one thing that I would just like to put out there. There was some concern in the past that a requirement of that nature may have some conflicts because essentially we would have to require individuals to be instructors to be able to provide those instructions over the phone. So that's one thing I think it's worth noting.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Currently the language on page 2, line 5 of the bill requires that a municipality shall require that emergency dispatchers of the 911 system be trained and currently certified in CPR. So this really doesn't apply to Department of Public Safety at all, does it?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I actually asked Department of Law that question, and they haven't got back to us on that yet. They said it could be interpreted to mean that we would not have to do that. However, we felt that if the 911 coordinator position was transferred over to the Department of Public Safety, that would be implied.
Thank you. Follow up. And the current language in here isn't talking about instruction. It's just talking about you're certified in CPR. Is that your understanding as well, or so? Is your testimony saying that that language should be changed and that should be a different requirement than is in the bill?
Through the chair, my only concern, the only thing I'm really saying is that if we train our dispatchers to the basic layman CPR standard, that they might not be considered qualified to actually
give CPR instructions over a telephone line, and that's based upon some prior research that was done apparently years ago with the American Heart Association that essentially said if you're going to tell somebody how to do CPR, you need to be an instructor, not just the basic CPR certification. So that's one of the things that we're trying to get clarification on at this time.
Okay, what I think we're going to do with the bill is there are enough questions on the committee. It's time to talk with the sponsor, and we'll just put it on until the next committee meeting or until the answers can be had. We have good information on the record now. So with that, but before we leave it, is there anybody else in the room or online that would like to testify on House Bill 361? The sponsor's representative wants to make another wrap-up, and I should have offered that to you. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Crystal Kinnaman, staff to Representative Fairclough. Representative Wilson, to one of your points that you were making earlier, if I did say that they were required, the different municipalities, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, they are emergency medical dispatchers. If I said they were required, I misspoke. They do that as within their own municipality. So that's not a requirement. That's just something that they have chosen to do, to take that higher level of training. And, you know, I would be more than happy to sit down with you, address any of your concerns, and, you know, any of the rest of the members on the committee to see what we can't do. I did want to one last thing, because we have gotten some pushback as to the training, you know, not only being trained in CPR, but then being able to explain that over the phone to somebody that has called in. That was something that we were planning on working with the department over the interim and the new 911 coordinator. Sildotna has expressed an interest in wanting to work with us and explain what they're doing currently, what's working best for them, and kind of find a balanced approach for the dispatchers across the state. Since I'm not a dispatcher, I don't want to, you know, go in and say, you know, this is what I think you guys should be doing. I think it's a discussion that the dispatchers across the state should have with the 911 coordinator to facilitate the training, both urban, rural, and remote parts of Alaska, and what works best. So that is, we are planning on taking that next step.
Okay. Thank you. So with that, public testimony is closed. We can reopen it if there's further reason to do so. But thank you, and we'll get back to this as when it makes sense.
Thank you.
If we could now, I'd like to go to House Bill 392. We have a new CS in front of us, and if somebody will move that CS so we have it here for consideration, we will ask the sponsor, Co-Chair Herron, or his representative to tell us where
we're at. We didn't adopt that last time?
Yeah. Is there, we need a, I don't think we did, no.
Butch, did we adopt S version last time?
I don't think so.
Okay, just Mr. Chairman, just for abundance of caution, Mr. Chairman, I move CS for to put CS for House Bill 392 S version in front of us.
Okay, the S version without objection. The S version is up for discussion.
Yeah,
Representative.
Can we get the explanation of the changes between?
Okay. That's an objection, then, and yes. We'll, for discussion, we'll go back to the sponsor. Would you explain the differences between version S and the previous version, please?
Yes. Both Dr. Carlo and Denise from the Senator's office are here, and I would ask them, Mr. Chairman, to do that for us.
Okay. Great. You would identify yourself for the record and give us your briefing.
For the record, my name is Nakush Carlo, staff to Representative Herron. The change in version S from the previous version is on page 5, line 15. This clarified language That it inserts to not fewer than three participants employed in very hard to fill positions.
Can you turn it up for us, please? Thank you.
So page 5, line 15, inserted the words to not fewer than three participants employed in very hard to fill positions.
And that's the only change?
Mm-hmm.
And that was neat. Do you have a copy of the current one? All I have is E version. Sorry.
Sorry.
Okay. Do you have further comments for us before we go into... We have, I do want to say that Diane Behrens from the Commission of Post-Secondary is online, the director, and for questions. And but if you would put us back into where we were when we left off. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, so the last time we you met was Tuesday, and... HB 392 creates a support for service program that's an incentive program within the Department of Health and Social Services. The emphasis is on the incentive portion. It also does loan repayment. That would also be run out of the Department of Health and Social Services. I believe at the last meeting you left with a question to the department over the fiscal note requiring one full-time employee.
Are there any questions for the sponsor or the sponsor's representative?
Mr. Chairman, we may have to go back to Representative Seaton's question about the changes. We have the S version and the Mr. Chairman, was the previous version E?
I believe it was.
Yes, that is correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, we have... Representative Seaton has E, and we've looked at S, and they appear to be identical.
Oh, I apologize. The on page 5 of version E, after line 12, they left, this is a typo, it should have continued on the next line to say continuing participant. So that was a typo fixed by Leg Legal.
Okay, so
and there was a typo on line 15. Hard to fill was needed to be hyphenated.
Let's take a little of ease here until we figure out where we're at. We've got the right version in front of us, and it was pretty much as stated on the record already, so proceed. Or do you have any questions for the Representative Wilson?
Just one question, and I don't know whether this would be a good idea or not. Had you thought about defining hard to fill, or would that change as you fill positions?
That might change, but as the bill is written, that would be worked out in the regulations.
Oh, okay. That's all. Thank you.
Follow up on that. Diane Behrens, are you online?
I am.
Did you have a comment on that question? Did you hear it?
I did not hear it, sir. Could you repeat it?
Yeah, it had to do with the question of what hard to fill or very hard to fill, how you'd make those determinations.
For the record, Mr. Chair, this is Diane Behrens, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Those sorts of determinations would be left up to the program managers at Health and Social Services. We would not be making those determinations.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Thank you. And Diane, I guess I'm just wondering what is happening in loan repayments. A whammy is either 3 or 4 year on the loan repayments. I guess this bill has 6 years of availability of either loan repayments or the direct incentives. Do we have any other programs that run for that duration, that run that long?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, first let me correct a misstatement I made at the last hearing. The two WAMI terms are 3 years for underserved areas or 5 years for urban areas. I misspoke when I said it was 4 years for the urban areas. The other thing is that it's important to understand the distinction between the fundamental structure of the WAMI program. The agreement that students enter into there, they enter into when they are starting their first year of their graduate medical program. The funds are paid directly to the University of Washington School of Medicine. And what the students do is they enter into a contract that says if they fail to return to Alaska to practice for a specific period of time, that service obligation will convert into a loan. If they do return timely to Alaska, that loan, if you will, is deferred until such time as they either fully discharge their service obligation or that they leave the state with some unmet obligation, in which case it then converts into active repayment. We do not have currently active another program that is structured like this. There is a very small teacher education loan that is structured very similarly to WAMI. And the requirement there is also 5 years for teaching in a rural school. You can have up to 100% of your debt forgiven. The structure that this bill proposes, really, although it allows for somebody to renew for up to a total of 6 years, the way it's currently structured, depending on the amount of their debt, they could, if it's small enough, they could have it paid off in the first 3 years of a term of service.
Follow up, Reverend Seaton.
So I guess this, as this is a direct incentive, and my understanding now is this is for any student loan or any loans, I guess they're student loans, but the question that I have is, if they're not a Alaska state loan, is there any difference between us going through repayment of loans that they've gotten from other sources versus just making the cash payment, because the loan repayment and the direct incentive, you know, has this combined amount? And I'm just trying to figure out if we're getting into a lot of paperwork for something that really doesn't influence us at all. I mean, if we're going to give them $47,000 of a combination as an incentive, why are we getting into their loans unless they are loans through the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that's an extremely valid question. And one of the whole idea of this program has sort of evolved over the years. There's been a similar proposal introduced to the legislature, gosh, going back as far as 10 years that I can recall. And it's only recently that the direct incentive portion has been brought into it with cash payments proposed. So I think to some extent the loan repayment feature is vestigial from the old versions, and in fact we've discussed with some of the working groups around the state that with the direct incentive included, having the student loan repayment piece in there is somewhat duplicative, as you've described.
And follow up?
Go ahead.
And could we just take care of that by putting a reference to loan repayment of amount and then just have that reference to the Alaska Student Loan Program so that we wouldn't be getting into government loans, you know, federal loans or other state loans or private loans, and reduce your paperwork so that the only thing that would be counting is the Alaska student loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Staton, I think that's a very different objective than was originally intended when the program was put in place. You could do that. The reason they used a broad education loan eligibility was to be able to recruit from outside the state. So, you know, you could make that change. It would certainly limit the type of participant who would receive a loan repayment benefit, but that may be a moot point if, in fact, they can get the balance of their benefit in a direct incentive payment.
And so, Mr. Chairman, that was my question. It seemed like it might administratively make things a lot cleaner since we are doing a direct cash incentive and we have amounts here, and it's a combination of that and the loan repayment. So I'd just like to suggest that we, you know, see if there, I can't see any downsides, and that's what I'm asking Diane Behrens, if there's any downside, since you can have that, there's that combination of loan and cash for those non-Alaska loans, that it just be cash. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Very good question, and I will look for guidance from the sponsor as far as what he would like to do, if he'd like to work on that or whatever. But Representative Wilson.
You know, to me, this is a bill that's all going to come down to the finances. We know we're short on these types of things. I like the part that even the hospitals can give part and the state gives part, whatever it takes to fill it. And if there's no more questions, I think we need to move it along to see what can be done, because I think the doctor shortage is only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. So if you don't mind, if nobody has any other questions.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
I know, very unusual out of me, of all people.
I'm
so. Okay. So I move CS.
Hold on.
Like,
don't get
it.
Yeah.
Well, 5 o'clock, he ends with time. I've got 4 minutes.
Is there anybody in the room
or
online that would like to testify further on the bill?
Did you have
I'd like to ask Representative Herron, the sponsor, what his preference would be.
I think that Representative Seaton brings up some good points. It was in part of my question to Mr. Struer at our last meeting, and it's fiscally related. The policy that we need, that this committee, I think, needs to take is, yes, recognizing we have a problem. Should we put a model in place that'll maybe reduce those shortages? And I agree with Representative Wilson that the Finance Committee should decide if this is something that we can afford at the moment. So the wishes of the committee are fine with me.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And we could either, you know, the concern that I was relating to making things much more expeditious for and easier for us in the state to administer this without getting in all of the other loans could be done by a conceptual amendment if the sponsor would be, you know, unless you see some downside to that. I think it would streamline the bill and make it easier and more attractive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I think that we could if you want to put it in the form of a conceptual amendment, and then we could talk about it, and then we could, I mean, is it just that, just a conceptual amendment that we find another way to administer this?
Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, it's just limiting the loans to Alaska state-issued loans instead of trying to mix and match loans with federal loans and others, so that the loan amount and then the direct incentive would make up the same, you know, would be up to the same amount of money, but we wouldn't be getting into trying to figure out everybody's federal loans or private loans or other things.
Yes, sir. That's fine.
Is that an amendment that you would like to offer, Representative Seaton? If it is, go right ahead.
I would. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer that as conceptual amendment to restrict the loans to those that are offered by the state of Alaska, and so that the amount being considered with the loan repayment plus the direct incentive would be the same amount, but we would narrow the amount of the loans that we would get involved with.
I'm going to object.
Object for discussion.
And the reason I'm going to, Mr. Chair, is I think this has been taken after things that are currently working on these kind of programs. And although it seems like we're giving them the same by giving them a lump sum versus making their payments, I think by making their payments is taking that relief off of the doctor for that period of time as they're I just want to make sure we're not limiting who we can bring in, and I'm just not sure whether we are.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I like where the maker of the amendment is trying to go with this, in that it's simplifying the paperwork and saying, why are we in the business of doling out checks here, there, and all that, and all the administrative costs? I like that idea. If that's what we're trying to do, I think that's wonderful. I want to make sure we aren't creating any unintended consequences, and I know that's why we did it in the conceptual amendment, to make sure that we're not changing the ratio of loans, or how much can be given out in loans versus how much can be given out in direct incentives, and somehow skewing who is eligible to receive the money in general. But as long as it's simply making sure that we're not in the business of writing checks to every which person and keeping track of who has loans where and where the checks are going, I'm completely in agreement if that's the intent to reduce the administration.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
And that is in the intent, and the reason we're not taking out all loans is we want to make sure that we get the repayment of the state loans that we've made, but you know, the rest is set out here, and the only place that this is covered is payments under the section when combined with the loan payment may not exceed this amount. So it's a generalized capped amount, and what isn't made as a loan payment is going to be made as the other, as a cash incentive payment. So
I'll remove my objection. It's another thing that finance can decide.
Representative Wilson, go ahead.
Yeah, just object. My objection's gone.
Oh, you're removing your objection. How about?
Mr. Chairman, I also remove my objection.
Okay, before we proceed then, I want to know, Dr. Carlo, did you have any comments on our discussion that we've been having?
I just want to emphasize that an applicant is eligible for the program if they have no loans. So. So you keep that in mind.
Thank you for that clarification. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Does the committee have? Oh yes, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment passed. Then is that?
Sure. Yeah, the objection was removed. The amendment passed. Thank you. I didn't clarify that on the record.
Just very quickly, I'm very much behind where this bill is going. I think it's we all know that we have these shortages and that we need to make it competitive for people to come up here. I very much like where it's going. We've had some extensive conversations with the office of both the bill sponsor and the sponsor of the companion bill on the other side, and I agree with my companion here to my left that's going to come down to a financial question, and I support us moving this bill along.
Before I ask for motion, I'd like to put a couple things on the record. One is I'm uncomfortable in this bill. I'm not going to stand in the way. I'm going to vote no rec. But my discomfort is not because of the good intentions of the sponsor at all. I mean, that's fantastic. My discomfort is how far removed the market is from this process. That won't change with this bill. That's an ongoing concern of mine. But, you know, I have to ask myself the question, why are we having to subsidize the salaries of people, you know, in these categories? Obviously, somebody, you know, there's something wrong. I mean, the services being purchased, rates that have been set by the government previously are not paying the way, so there's no incentive there. And so the whole thing philosophically gives me trouble. Plus, another discomfort I have is we're passing this bill, and again, to state the same thing again, if we move this bill out of committee, that we don't have enough information to make this decision. The new law that just passed in Washington, D.C. does have elements in it that talk about workforce development, and I don't know, I don't have a clue how they affect this bill, and I just want to put on the record again that I would reserve my right, you know, to call this issue back at some point in the future to renew our thoughts and discussion and decision on it. With those caveats, what's the will of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chairman. I move CS for House Bill number 392 / S with amendment and individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Time out just a little bit.